Hi, everybody. I am Francisco Gil-White. Thank you for joining us, Friends of More, Friends of Management of Reality. We are joined here today by Enrique Pressburger for our Monday English language podcast. I'm going to say a few words about Enrique because today he is presenting his book, which is a really important investigation. It's called The Terror Job. And the subtitle is, forgive me, an economic view of the terrorism industry, if we can call it that, right?
That's a great way to put it. The terrorist industry. Yeah.
So Enrique is actually a very interesting guy. So on the one hand, he is a businessman, but he's also an academic. He goes around giving conferences and doing research, as he's going to tell us about just now in a second. And he's bringing a business focus to the analysis of the terror infrastructure around the world, in particular, the anti-Semitic terror infrastructure around the world. And it's a very interesting analysis because you get to see that there is an enormous amount of top-down structure fueling terrorism. There's an enormous amount of money and much of it, perhaps the overwhelming share of it, right, Enrique, is not coming from Muslim countries. It's coming from the West.
Exactly, which is contradictory, but interesting at the same time.
Well, it's counterintuitive for sure. Okay, so let's. I'm going to give you the microphone, Enrique. Show us what you've got because you've got some interesting slides. People should see the cover of your book and so on, and tell us where to find it.
Yes, of course. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, Francisco. I'm sure this is going to be a really interesting talk. So yeah, I guess I'll be presenting my slides. And then if you want to ask something or say something that I'm sure you can contribute a lot, we can do it in the middle of the presentation. And at the end, maybe we can save some space for additional comments. So.
Fantastic.
So yeah, let's dive into this. So, well, I'm just making sure you can see my screen, right? Can you see the presentation?
Yeah, we can see it. It looks good.
Okay, great. So I'm going to start. Okay. So, well, this is the cover. So I like the cover a lot. It's designed by me and ChatGPT together. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to put it as a characterization. It seems like a cartoon because it's what it looks to me. So this characterized man that is a Hamas man who is trying to look as a businessman. That's why he's wearing a tie with his colors, but at the same time has a rifle and he's covered up by the multilateral organizations and the press, which is an interesting alliance that we're going to cover up in the term I call ideological laundering, which is a term derived from money laundering, but now we can also define the term of ideological laundering. But well, let's deep dive into it, into the core of the content, and let's start talking about precisely the multilateral organizations, about the UN, because well, this is the vehicle not only of argumenting and sustaining the propaganda, but it's a financial vehicle, which is sustaining an entire business. So the first fact that I want you to write down and that you'll be falling off your chair is this one, the following, that 25% of all UN employees are Palestinians living in Gaza. So yes, I'll rephrase it again. One in every four UN staff members are Palestinians in Gaza. So this has a name in the business world, in any given world, called conflict of interest. So it's not only the UNRWA, which is obviously a disproportionate in size, a big agency that it's, we know that the UN has two ways of dealing with refugees, one for the Palestinians and one for the rest of the world. So the one caring for the rest of the world is taking care of 75 million almost refugees is one agency that has half of the budget and half of the employees. And then you have the Palestinian specialized one that has that doubles the budget, doubles the employees, and not only that, it turns out to be the biggest agency of all the UN and one of the biggest agencies in the whole world. And not only that, they have one of the highest paid salaries with an average of $300,000 to $400,000 a month. So they're very well paid and is the biggest agency of the UN with the most employees. And well, yes, please.
Can you return to that slide?
Yes.
So I think it's important to make very clear here that, so you say 25% of all UN employees are Palestinians, which is already amazing, but UNRWA has almost exclusively Palestinian employees. Practically everyone who works at UNRWA is an Arab Palestinian. Isn't this true?
Yes, exactly. That's what I say. I mean, this is outrageous in the sense that it's as if the DEA of the United States suddenly has 25% of its payroll of one of the cartels. You know, I mean, it's, I mean, the inside people working in a supposedly neutral and global organization, I mean, it's so outrageous that they have so many people. I mean, it's a great conflict of interest.
And it's probably also important to point out that UNRWA, so only the Palestinians have a refugee agency or a UN agency dedicated only to them. They're the only people in the world that has a specific UN agency only for them. So it seems like, you know, either the UN really, really, really loves the Palestinians, or they really hate the Jews, and this is a way of putting pressure on Israel, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that's definitely it. And not only that, I mean, it's also full of perverse incentives, because this is the only law in the world. I mean, I'm talking about the refugee law, where it's by heritage, the status of refugee. So this means that originally the Arab population that claims to be a refugee in the conflicts after the war, that actually this six Arab countries invaded Israel when the UN declared the two states. Well, these numbers were about, depends who gives you the numbers, but 300,000 to 700,000 Palestinians. And now you are talking about 6 million of Palestinians, 9 million Palestinians if you take account communities abroad. So it is the only conflict in the world where there's more refugees year by year because they have a differentiated law. And this means the UNRWA needs more employees and more budget per refugee. So it's an agency that continuously grows economically and needs more budget and needs more employees. So not only is the biggest right now, but it's constantly growing because of this, you can see as a differentiated or discriminatory law to favor certain conflict and certain people.
Just before we move on to the next topic, I want to make clear to everyone that the reason there are so many Palestinian quote-unquote refugees is that the UN defined an Arab Palestinian refugee as anyone who had been living, anyone who is not a Jew, right? Anyone who's a Muslim, an Arab or Muslim, who had been living in Mandate Palestine, British Mandate Palestine, just 2 years before the war of 1948. So if you arrived, say, from Algeria in 1946 as an immigrant, right? You're a Muslim immigrant from Algeria, and you landed in British Mandate Palestine in 1946, then you're considered an Arab Palestinian refugee, and so are all of your descendants. Okay? So if you arrived in 1946, and then in 1948, in the war of 1948, you emigrated to Turkey or Chile or wherever, you're still considered a Palestinian, and so are all of your descendants. They're all considered Palestinian refugees. That's why there's so many Palestinian refugees. And this is a definition of Palestinian refugee that the UN has never used a definition like this for any other people in any other context And the effect of it is to make gigantic the population of people who can present grievances against the state of Israel according to this grammar. So this should also be understood, because the entire policy is skewed against Israel in ways that are never, these policies are not implemented anywhere else for any other people.
Well, that's a great amount of data. So yeah, thanks for making clear that. And yeah, I mean, it's a clear conflict of interest. And well, people will say, okay, but I mean, it's not only the employees. So the UNRWA also invests in schools. So yeah, exactly. The UNRWA, the UN, some of the money, because the majority goes to salaries and administrative costs, but some of it, they do invest in UN schools. But now we're going to look, this is a very interesting video. I'm going to show only one video, so don't worry, a 2-minute video of a compilation of various UNRWA schools around the state of Israel, showing up what the kids, the Palestinian kids, are being taught inside UN schools with full of Western money, which we're going to see later on. Let me just put a video play.
لأنه نعمل حرب إنه نفرج اليهود إنه إحنا مش 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 إنه إحنا مش مشقين إحنا أوعية كمان في ناس بدو بحبوا فلسطين بدهم يحاربوا وبضحوا بدمهم عشان فلسطين أنا بدي أهزمهم بالحرب بدي أهزمهم
بعلمونا إنه الأقصى إلنا وإلنا يعني الحق يعني إلنا فلسطين والأراضي كلها إلنا لأنهم بسبب كذبهم وانتهاكاتهم إنهم يقولون إن الهيكل تحت المسجد الأقصى ولا مرة إنه يكون الهيكل تحت المسجد الأقصى.
أقرأ اليهود.
بعلمونا إن الصهيونية هم أعدائنا وهم أهم إشي لازم يسووا فيهم عملية.
يعني إنهم بيعلمونا بالمدرسة إنهم إرهابيين و
بيحكوا لنا عن اليهود. إنهم هدول مش منيح وهدول بقتلوا قاعدين بشبابنا.
بحكولنا هدول غدارين. بحكولنا إنه هدول بغدرونا هدول مش منيح. إذا بطعن بدعس عليهم. أعمل عمليات. الدعس.
عمليات الدعس عمليات الطعن. والاشتباك المسلح في المخيمات.
إيش أكيد هدول العمليات ترفع الرأس ولفلسطين. العملية هاي تحت الدعس والسكاكين هاي اشي بيرفع الراس لفلسطين
بس بدك بطلع بس الشباب
انا ان شاء الله اساعد الشباب وان شاء الله اصير مقاوم بالمستقبل مع الدولة الاسلامية.
So where? So these are what they are learning inside UN schools, which then after we learn that some of the UNRWA staff was working actively with Hamas, then we shouldn't be surprised, because all the school system is invaded with this kind of education. So that's when it starts to blur the line between the UN and the Hamas corporations. Interesting. Talking about salaries, so I found out that all the people that work for the government, I mean, the biggest employment provider for the Palestinians are government jobs and UN jobs, which are the largest employment sources in the world. In both of them, they get their money from Western sources. So a lot of Western countries, which we're gonna see in a few minutes on graphs, they get money as official, you know, just money quantities they receive year by year by Western governments. And they receive also money via the UN. And so both of parties, they get from $3,000 to $4,000 a month. And the refugees, the actual civilians from the Palestinian populations, they actually not working for the government or not working for the UN, they get as aid from $100 to $250 a month. So people in the streets, they don't get basically none of the money intended to them. So they are all kept by the administrative people, which clearly have an incentive of keep the conflict going. And not only that, if you go further into the investigation, you see that if you take an average of all the government officials and the UN employees, which again, they have an average of $3,500 a month. That's that income, that monthly income is higher than the GDP per capita of entire regions. So that's doubling up the income of Central Europe, of Eastern Europe as well. It's three times more than the average income in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Russia, in the Balkans, in more than three times than South America, than the Middle East in general, Africa, South Africa, Jordan, Egypt, etc. So, I mean, if you work for the Palestinian government or for the UN, you'll be by far, you'll have the best paid job around the entire region, and you'll be positioned well above the average of the GDP per capita of all the region around you. And what I was saying before, that Francisco was complementing very valuable information, this graph shows it perfectly. So the more refugees, the more money and jobs for UNRWA, because you had 300,000 in 1948, but then you have almost 6 million now claiming that support and the need of employees. So as the ratio of the Palestinian refugee grows, then the need of this budget for the government and for the UN grows as well. And this leads to this third graph that you can see at the bottom of the budget of the UN growing from the 1950s to the 2020, almost to $18 billion, growing constantly year by year, sustainably, because the UN needs more money. So that's why this agency has become so strong and has so much money, which, well, it's very interesting to see all this conflict of interest. And also one of the very, well, the most important points is, okay, so now to put some order on the ideas. Okay, so the UNRWA has a differentiated law and has a differentiated budget. And their budget is growing year by year, and they're massively gathering more money as time passes, right? But who gives that money? And then as I started to do my research on who funds actively these UN organizations, so I found that it's the US, the European Union, Germany, the UK, Sweden, and Canada. So basically, all this conflict of interest is being financed so far by Western countries, which, I mean, you can say, okay, so they're giving money to the UN, to a cause, to a multilateral organization. Yeah, but as you see that this multilateral organization became a 25% employee role of a certain people in a certain conflict, and then their school system is being diverted, then you're directly funding something else, which is for sure not precisely economic integration nor peace. So, well, one of the theses of the book is that UNRWA doesn't aim to solve the conflict or the refugee problem, because its existence depends on the problem staying unsolved. As the problem gets unsolved and the refugees grow and the problem and the conflict stays, then they as an entity, they'll keep growing. And because they're very well paid people, their interest is to keep being like that. Well, that's another perspective of UNRWA compared to other UNICEF, the World Food Program, just so you can see another perspective. But you wanted to say something, Francisco.
Yeah, I wanted to point something out that is very important in your research, which is that what you're showing is that first of all, most of the money is not going to the refugees; it's going to the bureaucrats.
Exactly.
In the Palestinian Authority, and also is UNRWA money going also to Hamas?
Yeah, some of it definitely is going to Hamas.
Okay, so that means that UNRWA money is mostly going to the terrorists, because the Palestinian Authority is a terrorist organization, and in fact, as you're going to mention a little bit later, I know they're paying salaries of Jew killers. Right. So they're definitely a terrorist organization. And Hamas, of course, is a terrorist organization. So most of the money is going to terrorists, thereby incentivizing terrorism. And also, you pointed out that they're making more money than government employees almost anywhere else. it seems to me, or anywhere else. So what this flow of money is doing is it's convincing terrorists that terrorism pays. That's what this money is doing.
Exactly. I mean, and it's obviously benefiting a political elite and bureaucracy mainly. And that's why all the system is designed this way. But the most interesting thing is that people will claim that it's not dark money. I mean, at the end, it's official UN donation. It's official contribution to schools. So, I mean, if you go and scan the traditional financial system, I mean, a lot of it will seem to be transparent and clean, because at the end, it's a donation to schools. Yes, but then if you see what's being thought in those schools, then you start asking questions. And then and that's what this slide intends to show. Oh, so we had no idea Hamas as well stored weapons inside of schools and launched rockets from our schools and hides hostages and kills people in our schools. Actually, we have this case in Mexico, a Mexican of nationality as well. So we had this case of Orion Hernandez, which is a hostage that wasn't even Jewish, but he was killed at the Nova Festival, tortured and killed. And he appeared several months afterwards. The IDF retrieved his body from beneath a UN installation. So not only that, the official money to schools was perverting the education system, but these installations were used and are being used to this day as the basis. I mean, also the Central Intelligence Command was beneath hospitals and schools and UN installations. So, this answering your question of the line, the blur line, when talking about financing aid and financing terrorism, right? Which is obviously not a clear division. And here we have some facts about the leader of Hamas being a professor. The leader of Hamas in Lebanon, it turned out to be a professor in UNRWA. I mean, this is some of the very public cases because, I mean, the Israel army has hundreds of people suspected or proven to have participated and kidnapped people and in the killings. But, I mean, this is the most...
Army?
Sorry?
Which army?
I mean, the IDF, the Israel Defense Army, has a lot of evidence that, which is linking UNRWA staff to terrorist activities. And we know there are several hundreds of them. But there were only a few public cases that made it to the press. One of them is this leader of Hamas in Lebanon, you know, working closely as the attaché to Hezbollah, which was obvious that he was also a professor hired by the UN. So this is one of the few cases that went public that he was clearly a terrorist and clearly working for the UN at the same time. There's lots of them, hundreds of them, but only a few of them became public. And UNRWA, their speech always was, oh, we had no idea we had some employees that were terrorists. Oh, we have no idea that we had tunnels beneath our headquarters. We had no idea that we had weapons beneath our schools and rockets. We had no idea that some hostages were in our installations. I mean, so that's a thing we have to question more seriously. And this is also, I mean, some of the footage, we have plenty of it available in different IDF sites of the UN actually working with terrorists. In the sense that the UN installations usually are protected because the Israel army doesn't go into the headquarters of the claimed UN installations. So, I mean, there has been clear footage showing vehicles of the UN transporting Hamas terrorists or arms. And more than that, I mean, some of the terrorists also get some vehicles and they put some UN stickers or UN of other international organizations as this World Kitchen Aid organization. So they also put some insignias to cheat the international press. And as they know that Israel won't attack UN compounds, then they collaborate to transport delicate things as arms or other stuff. So that's also have been documented. And well, that's another photo of the graduation, of the kindergarten graduation of the parents being present in a ceremony of killing a, an Israeli soldier, right?
So the fact that this is a graduation and that the children are made to enact the execution of an Israeli soldier means that this is the highest value. I mean, so at graduation, you have to show your teachers that you learned the most important thing, right? And this is what they consider the most important thing. This is the key learning that they get from their education is that they must kill Jews.
Definitely. And I think this is the greatest problem of the Palestinian cause so far, because they put first the destruction and the genocidal destruction and denial of the Jewish states before their own national determination. So, I mean, if you're talking about independence and destroying the Jewish states, it's on the top is the destruction of the Jewish states and then their national determination. So if they don't ever change those priorities, I don't think there's any possibility of reaching a serious peace agreement, right? Because, that's a distortion of values, history, and a lot of things. And the incentive of keeping the system like that is precisely the multilateral organizations, which we already know because of this book, that there's a lot of money involved. And this is Orion. I was talking about this one beforehand. This Mexican that was a father of a girl, and actually, his girlfriend was Shani Luke, which became a pretty famous hostage afterwards. They saw she was raped and killed as well, and the photograph of her pelvis broken and she being unconscious and people spitting on her. That picture won the best picture of the year of the Associated Press. So we know what we're talking about. And those two people, Orion and Shani, they were both hidden at UN installations. And this is another aspect. So we are talking so far about the UN and the budgeting and multilateral organization. But there's another compound of these economic pervert incentives. And another one is, besides the UN, there are official budget initiatives to give from the Western country to the Palestinian governments, mainly the Palestinian authorities, but also to Hamas. And they might not be targeted as terrorism, but as aid partidas, as aid packages, to put it some way, for the Palestinian governments. So that's also a huge amount of money, and we have to understand that many of the people, to understand this, we have to understand the employee structure in the Palestinian society. So in Gaza, for example, 60% of the people are poor. They don't work, and the few that work, they work in Israel. So 85% of the people that actually have a job in Gaza, their income comes from Israeli sources, because I mean that's a proof that they rather work in Israel, because ironically is the only country that give jobs to Palestinian people in Gaza, normal jobs, because Egypt has its border completely closed for Palestinians working in Egypt, and neither Jordan neither other neighboring countries want to give jobs to Palestinian people. But my point was that there's not many people actually working. The few that are working, they receive their income from Israel. But the rest, I mean, there's not a lot of taxing in the Palestinian society. I mean, there is, but not a lot. So they cannot operate embassies around the world and of this budget they need. And that's why they need foreign assistance. So they have huge contribution for Western governments that they use to politically operate. And that's a money they don't have to give back any type of accountability in response. So they get money from the European Union, from the US, from NGOs, and that money they can spend it whatever they want, basically. And what's interesting in this slide, it's not only the quantity, and that again, besides via the UN and via multilateral organizations, that again, we see this pattern. So the budget given to Palestinian governments mainly come from the Western countries. So, well, that's the first interesting fact. Nearly 80% of the budget come from Western countries, governments and institutions. But the other interesting part is to see that Iran, Qatar, and Turkey, also declared enemies of the state of Israel, they give below 10% of the money labeled to budget, government budget. So the question is, okay, so we know that these three countries, Iran, Qatar, and Turkey, they give arms, and maybe they will give money outside the system to terrorist organizations, but through official channels, they don't give the majority of the money. So then where's their money going? And their money going, their money is going precisely to the West, to the academia in the West, and to Western press and Western institutions. And that's where this perverse cycle starts. So the Palestinian governments are getting their majority of their sourcing and their funds from multilateral organizations and from Western governments. And so the real enemies of the state of Israel, the usual enemies, the public enemies, Iran, Qatar, Turkey, they don't need to give money to official channels, and they rather finance this Western anti-Semitism, and that's where their full budget is going to, which we're going to see also.
Wait, can you go back?
Yes.
So when you say nearly 80% of the budget comes from Western government and institutions, you're including in that the NGO money and the United Nations money, or are you just adding up the USA and the European Union?
Yeah, I mean it's a different way of sourcing money. I mean, this is besides UNRWA, to put it some way. So, I mean, it is specifically built for the Palestinian people as the UNRWA, but besides giving money through the UN, there's direct money being injected from Western governments to the Palestinian governments.
Okay, so, but I just want to make clear one thing, that in this chart that you're showing us, the NGO money, that's also mostly European Union and US money.
Yes, yes, that's
and,
a great.
And the United Nations money is also mostly European Union and USA money.
Definitely.
So the Western contribution to the terrorists is actually, so the relative size of the Western contribution versus the Muslim states is really staggering.
Definitely. It's the majority of the budget. So that's the paradox, precisely. So why are these countries keep financing this conflict if it's clearly not going anywhere but to strengthen the terrorist groups? So yeah, of course, that's one of the questions people reading the book or hearing this presentation is going to ask. So wait a minute. So why are Western governments asking about and demanding a ceasefire and demanding the end of the conflict when they are the ones mainly perpetuating this system that clearly does not benefit directly the Palestinian civilians and only is benefiting the bureaucrats and the elites of this Palestinian conflict, and they're the ones keep fueling the system. So exactly that's I'm grateful that you asked this question, because this is precisely one of the things that people reading the book has to be shaken by, right? So yeah, definitely. And well, I mean, talking about accountability, I mean, because nobody asks from the Palestinian government's return in any way. I mean, they just get the money from Western governments and they spend it. So they spend all of it. We know Hamas spends all of it in military investment or military expenditures, as well as Palestinian authorities. And we have seen clearly this in images, right? So Hamas people just tearing off the pipes for water systems in Gaza and destroying the pipes to build more rockets to launch into Israel. And yes, I mean, because they keep getting free money from Western governments, in which they don't have any accountability to say how you're spending your money, that's obviously a direct consequence to the precarious lifestyle of the Palestinian civilians at the end. So their budget is used in rockets, and it's not used in power plants, which are dependent in energy from the state of Israel. They don't have civilian shelters because they use civilians as shields, and so they have no shelters. And they have no water infrastructure, no basic services, because they get a lot of money, but they don't use that money for any civil infrastructure. They use all of it into terrorist infrastructure. So there's a lot of money, but as nobody asks them any accountability for their money spent, then obviously they'll keep spending the money in inflating and perpetuating the conflict, which is also, of course, an economic perverse incentives. And now there's this third part of the investigation, which Francisco was already dipping into it, which is terrorism as a social policy, because that's a third thing. So the first thing is direct funding from the international institutions as the UN. The second one is direct budget received from Western governments. But the third one is this system of awarding terrorism as an economic activity and using it as a form of subsidy and a form of family business. And this is very interesting. So, as a company selling Coca-Colas have incentives.
Oh, wait. Yes, Enrique, your title up there is in Spanish. It says bonos por desempeño. What should it be in English?
Well, yeah, thanks for that correction. Yeah, should this be
you want to correct it? You want to put it in English? I think it's bonuses for a particular activity, right?
Personal achievements. We'll put it. Okay. Yeah, it's like awards for, like in the business world, like executives, okay. If they make an outstanding performance and instead of selling the 100% of the plant, they sell 200%, then they'll get a bonus, usually in salary or in shares, because they excelled in a structure. So then they will pay better and they will get incentives for excelling in their jobs. Okay. So that system of rewarding, of corporate rewarding, it's also being implemented here by the terrorist organizations. So, for example, what's more interesting of it is that everything I'm going to read now, it's public information. I mean, people know, and there's other books written about this, as our friend Edwin Black, which also wrote a similar book, which is called Pay for Slay. I mean,
No. It's called Financing the Flames.
Financing the Flames. Yeah, you're right. Thanks for the question. But I mean, what I mean is that this system of paying terrorists for killing people and awarding them for this system is a system that has been known for decades. I mean, it's not something new. And so people are very aware of it. It's not something that came out after October 7. I mean, this from day one, these Palestinian governments, since they were born, they have used a significant part of their budget to stimulate and award killings of Jews as social policy. And now let's analyze this as a family business. So if you attempt to murder a Jew, you'll get $10,000. And if you're successful, I mean, if you're successful in your attack and you actually did kill a Jew, you'll get a residential apartment. And that's why now it's very controversial that Israel usually strikes the property of the terrorist and destroys the property. And well, one of the reasons is because they got that apartment in many cases precisely because they became successful in killing a Jew. So the Palestinian government is going to reward them with cash and with an apartment. And so that's an incentive for becoming a terrorist. But if the terrorist also dies, then the family will also receive an award in cash, and their family, they're going to receive a lifetime pension of $350 a month, which is 50% higher than the average aid received by a Palestinian refugee. So let's analyze this. Let me finish. If also the terrorist doesn't die and goes to jail, then he will get paid as long as he remains in jail. And the harder the sentence, and that means the more severe is the crime, and the more time he gets in jail, the more money he'll get from Palestinian governments. So 5 to 10 years, 600 a month, 10 to 20 years, 1,000 a month, over 20 years, 1,200 and life sentence 2,000 a month. So that's when the concept of disposable children emerges. So imagine this. So you have a family of six children and you send two of them to become killers, terrorists. So if one of them gets killed and the other one gets in jail, you can get as a family thousands of US dollars as subsidies without working, because you'll get some bonus residential apartments, then you'll get also lifetime pensions, and you go salary while your other son is in prison. So the whole system is rewarding people that don't want to go to work, and they're rewarding not only the killer, but the families, the entire families, getting cash and getting lifetime pensions as a reward for becoming terrorists. So it turns out that there's a better job of becoming a bureaucrat, which is becoming actually a terrorist. So either, I mean, the best situation you can have as a Palestinian in Gaza in terms of money, it's to become a bureaucrat working for the Palestinian Authority or Hamas or the UN, or to become a terrorist. So those are the highest income source employments in the Palestinian region, and it's all being financed by the West. And so they keep doing this, and that's where the concept of disposable children has been highly criticized in the West. I mean, not now, because now we're full of propaganda, but many people have asked, okay, so how can a mother send people to explode? I mean, how come mothers can educate people to be terrorists? So the answer is, okay, so besides the terrorist, the ideological conflict and the ethical conflict and the religious conflict, it's also being done because of money. I mean, if this system was forbidden, but was not incentivized anymore, and they would stop receiving money for being in jail or for killing Jews, maybe the system would for sure diminish, if not disappear. So that's also one of the very important points we want to make in this book. So this corrupt system of incentivizing economically terrorism, it has to stop. And one of the main routes is in the economic incentives. And well, besides, this is just to strengthen the military spending. I mean, I don't know if people have this clear. We know they have a lot of tunnels, but I don't know if you have this hard data that Gaza has turned into 15 times its size, 15 times. So we don't have one Gaza, we have 15, the equivalent to 15 cities of Gaza, and which all of them are beneath the ground, full of terrorist infrastructure. So, I mean, this is just to keep enforcing the point that there is money in the region, but the money goes to terrorists, goes to bureaucrats, goes to government officials, and goes to building 15 times the city in tunnels and terrorist infrastructures, in missiles, and different arms that went through the 150 tunnels found from Egypt to Gaza. That, well, they were just full operating, bringing arms and terror infrastructure to Gaza. And again, because this is a social policy, this is why 80% of people released from Israeli prison, they return to terrorist activities. More than 8 out of 10 people, of course. I mean, if they return and kill a Jew, then they'll get rewarded. But if they come back to terrorist activity and they get to jail again, their families are going to receive again a monthly salary. So for them, I mean, the incentive to come back to terrorist activities, it's all there. I mean, there's no reason why they will stop doing what they do. And that's why we all know that Sinwar, the mastermind of the October 7 attacks, is one of the clear examples that he was in jail. He was cured in jail, actually, by Israel medics. He had cancer, and so he was taken care of. He was cured in jail by the state of Israel. He got back to Gaza in an exchange hostage deal, and he came back to do terror activities in a more massive way than he did before. And because, to understand also in a deeper way this social policy, this not, I mean, we're seeing here the data of 2024, because we're not only talking about October 7. I mean, that was in 2023, remember, October 2023. But last year, only taking in count one full year, 2024, there were more than 500 terrorist attacks, stabbing attacks, shooting attacks, ramming attacks with cars, people killed in several ways because it's a social policy. So we have more, in average, more than one attack a day, 1.5 attacks a day, because it's a way of making income for the Palestinian families, which is a tragedy, but it's a fact. It's an economic fact. And well, another layer of these perverse incentives are that always, almost always, the leaders of the Palestinian authorities are very wealthy. So this is some of the most known cases. I mean, Yasser Arafat was maybe the one of the, I mean, before this conflict, he was the most known figure of the Palestinian leadership. And he was famous because he made a cover for this Forbes edition of most wealthy corrupt leaders or authorities. That means money outside the system, because Arafat was known for having hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign accounts, apartments in New York City and stuff like that. Same thing with Mahmoud Abbas, same thing with Ismail Haniyeh. I mean, they know hide their money more carefully in Turkey or in different Arab countries, but it is known and it has been exposed that they have accounts with hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign accounts, which again is another way of saying, okay, so this system, it's only benefiting the political elites, and terrorism is a system that it's benefiting economically also these elites. And so to start closing up, so I mean, how I usually get a question, how is this not exposed? I mean, this is so obvious. It's public information. I mean, why people is not talking about it? And the answer is because of ideological laundering. That, as I said before, as there's money laundering, which a concept is putting bad money into the system to make it look good, that's the same with ideology. So this ideology of awarding terrorism, educating hate and killings and the genocide of the Jewish states, so that is being turned around by the money of these enemies of Israel to the West, to international institutions and to international academia and to the international press. So then their ideology gets laundered and they suddenly become the victims of the conflict, and then the system can keep on going and moving because it has all been turned around. And well, here are some facts. This is also public information. I mean, I have these stats, but I'm sure you can Google this pretty easily. Just investigate how much money is going to American universities, and then you can see, then it gets interesting. So money to United States Ivy League universities or in general university comes through Qatar and through China and through Saudi Arabia and to Kuwait and to Russia and to Turkey, Iraq. Even the Palestinian Authority gives back some of the received money to American schools. So that's the paradox. Because the Western is financing the system, then the money, the actual big money of the enemies of Israel, such as Qatar, such as Saudi Arabia in some way, then their money, because it's not needed to finance these terrorist activities, then their money goes way back to the US and to Europe to finance the international press and academia to wash this hate ideology and turn it into friendly victims.
So one way of describing this, could you go back?
So, yes.
So one way of describing the system is that the jihadi states are sending money to the US universities so that these universities will teach anti-Semitism in the form of anti-Zionism to their university students. These university students then become the managers of the bureaucracies, both public and private. And so those bureaucracies then send all that money to the terrorists. So this is how the the ideological laundering process becomes a money circle for the jihadis.
Yes, which I mean, ironically, is working pretty good. We have these waves of propaganda that it's actually working because it's rooted and it's been done for many decades now. And so, yeah, it appears that it's working. And that's why we're because they're eventually integrate these bureaucracies, that's why nobody talks about it. I mean, even this is public information. And to, it's very important to point out that this system, this corrupt economic system, does not benefit the Palestinian civilians, which keep being a very poor population dominated by their elites, which aim to oppress them and keep the money to them. I mean, because it's not that, that this is the hidden alternative that at the end, you know, is benefiting the Palestinian people. Also, this system, I mean, it's obviously targeted to destroy Israel, but also at the same time, this corrupt economic system is also undermining the life of the most of the Palestinians, actually. So that's what's crazy about it. Even this ideological laundering hides the real opposition that exists of some of the Palestinian peoples trying to oppose the system. They also get oppressed by this ideological laundering, which is both damaging, both for Israel and the civilians. So, just to put it clear. And well, this is a summary. That I mean, I have more slides, but this is mainly the one worth, you know, doing a deep dive about it because of the time. So terrorism, it's a system also being legitimized by UN employees in what we're seeing and by law and stuff like that. We have enriched terrorist leaders and elites. I mean, there's a group that benefits economically for this. Terrorism is also a subsidy policy. It's a social policy that allows families to live out of this without the need to actually going to work. The third very important point is conflict escalation equals money. So the more the conflict gets deepened and endures more time and gets more critical, then they will get more money because they'll get emergency funds, emergency ONGs money, emergency additional employees, emergency agencies. So for them, the greater the conflict, the more money they get, which that's also a perverted incentive. And also there's this whole ideological laundering, making the system work well. And that originates all this anti-Jewish press that together with this academia ideological laundering, it keeps terrorism as a very lucrative system for a few, but the system keeps going and keeps sustaining all this incredible moment that we're living at this time. So this is it. This is not about ideology, it's about economics as well. Terrorists persist not because of faith, but because of well-structured incentives. And we need to fight institutional corruption in the media, NGOs, and multilateral organizations. And we need to replace subsidies with economic integration to foster dignity, productivity, and peace, if that's what really we want.
Okay, so I have a question here. So for a long time, because I had not done the deep dive that you have done, which is quite impressive. But I was aware that most of the money coming for jihadi terrorism was coming from the West. I was aware of that. And so for many years, I have been saying that the solution to the jihadi problem is simply closing the Western money spigot. So if the Western countries would suddenly stop funding all of this terror, this jihadi terror, then we wouldn't have a jihadi problem. It's the Western money producing the jihadi problem. Would you agree with that statement that if we close the spigot, we get rid of the jihadi problem by and large?
Yeah, definitely. And while, I mean, that's a crucial point, which again, if you reach the conclusion, I mean, I'm happy about it. Because that's the obvious, okay? So the money is being filled by the West, so just stop doing that. I mean, that's also a big part of the problem. I mean, and then now, I mean, ideology will persist and maybe this fanatism will persist. But if they don't have the power, the economic power, then for sure they'll have more probability to fail. And another very important point is in this world, we do need actually referees, like neutral referees, like neutral parties to solve conflict. So having a UN, a United Nations organization, it's important. I mean, nations and nation states will clash over time. They have done in the past, they will do in the future. And having at least neutral institutions, it's very important. So having a neutral Red Cross should be really important. I mean, I didn't talk about it in the presentation, but in the book I do. I mean, how come they didn't visit any hostage? I mean, you have to have a neutral UN. Doesn't matter who's the victim. The Red Cross has to check the health of the hostages. Yep. More if they're babies. But if the referee is not neutral, then we're fucked up. Same with International Court of Justice, same with the International Criminal Court, same with the UN. I mean, if they became corrupt organizations in employees, in money investments, in salaries, in size of the organizations, then it's not only that the West is financing them, but this institution, instead of becoming neutral referees, they are taking sides, perpetuating the conflict, and legitimizing the ideology so the system can keep running. So that's another very important blind spot. We need to expose and to be demanding these organizations to become less corrupt and more transparent, because actually we need them. We do need this type of organization for the future.
Okay, so I find something very interesting here, Enrique, which is that in the United States, there is a huge debate going on the MAGA right. Okay, so on the Make America Great Again movement that is supporting President Donald Trump, there's been a debate, very public debate recently about, you know, is it really consistent with the America First policy to be sending all of that support that the U.S. allegedly sends over to Israel, right? Well, I mean, the U.S. does send some money and military support for Israel, and so the America First people complain about that, saying, well, you know, is this really in the interest of the United States? But you never see them complaining about the giant rivers of money that are going to the jihadis. So, and right now we've only been talking about the Arab-Palestinian jihadis. We haven't discussed in this conversation all of the military aid that goes to Egypt, the arms sales to Saudi Arabia, the military aid for Lebanon, the very close relationship with Qatar, which is a major jihadi, a major supporter of jihadism. None of that, and we could go on and on. None of that is part of the complaint. When these America Firsters are complaining about, you know, U.S. money going towards foreigners, they're always complaining about Israel, which is a democracy, which is actually getting a smaller share than the much smaller share than the jihadis are getting. I'm about to publish an article on the complement to what you're doing here, which is the amount of aid and military weapon sales that is going to the jihadi states or states that are enemies of Israel, Muslim enemies of Israel. It's way, 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 way larger than what goes to Israel. And these people are not complaining about that. So that makes me suspicious about this MAGA movement, which claims to be very interested in reducing foreign aid, but they only ever seem to complain about foreign aid going to Israel, never to the jihadis.
Yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant way to put it. And well, the reason it's as because they buy the referees, they also buy the legitimization institutions. So the academia and the press, I mean, usually the critical thinking process of a person comes out in university, during university. I mean, for myself, at least it was like that. When I started, you know, going to university, I started to read more diverse books and having, you know, interesting teachers. And that's when you usually start to become a more critical thinker and, you know, to ask yourself if the rules you have been living to up at that time are fair, are right, etc. So, but if you have a kidnapped academia in the most prestigious academia, as Harvard, as Columbia, then, I mean, they are closing the circle with kidnapping the legitimation systems, which is the academia and the press. So people think that they're, you know, critically thinking, about when hating Israel, when not questioning this, and they do not realize that this is becoming part of the system. So they're unable to question the system because they're inside it. So that's a success of the jihadist countries, but this should be at least questioned. And
right.
Following the money is usually a good way to start.
So the university students are getting woke critical theory instead of scientific critical thinking. That's what's going on. Right. So they graduate from the university thinking that they've become, you know, very thoughtful and very aware and very awake or woke, right? When in reality, all they're doing is repeating dogmas, leftist cultural Marxist dogmas that are drenched in anti-Semitism, disguised as anti-Zionism, which, I mean, anti-Zionism, there's no sense in which anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, because people want to make that distinction, but they forget what the definition of Zionism is. Zionism is the effort to give the Jewish people a state where they can protect themselves from the repeated attempts to exterminate them that have been happening throughout Western history. That's Zionism. It's the nationalist movement of the Jews to have self-determination in their own state so that they can defend themselves. That's all Zionism is. So if you're an anti-Zionist, what that means is that you don't want the Jews to be able to protect themselves from extermination. And if you don't want the Jews to have that kind of protection, well, then you're an anti-Semite. Why would you want the Jews to be exposed to extermination? That unless you're an anti-Semite.
Definitely. And yeah, I'm having fun having this conversation because we do want people to wake up at the end. So this type of independent research that you're doing for many years and have become a reference, and us people have joined in a way, putting our small efforts to give conscience to the conversation. This is what has to happen, you know? People start questioning these things and try to think differently for what the universities and the press are saying. And yeah, hopefully that will have to happen. So it's not about only questioning the dogmas, but also questioning the reputation of the ones who expose them. I mean, why do we have keep thinking about the UN as a great organization if it no longer is? Maybe it was, maybe it can become again, but right now it's not.
No.
And the Red Cross is not either. So right. They shouldn't be a prestigious organization as long as they become corrupt in supporting terrorist activities. It should be said without any, you know, directly. Because you know, if you want to solve the problem, you have to be direct about it. And I don't know why, I mean, you know, the example I was putting before. So if the DIA turns out to have drug cartel,
the Drug Enforcement Agency.
Well, that's what I meant. Sorry. I mean, but my point is, the CEO should be fired. So the same goes here again. I mean, if the UN turns out to have 25% of his workforce full of one group full of
terrorists,
and they show that they're working with them with vehicles in beneath the schools, rocket launchers and whatever. So the CEO should be fired because he's responsible, as in the business world happens, you know.
Absolutely.
So why here it's not the case? Why? I mean, so you know, yeah, just some thoughts about what should be done.
Fantastic. Enrique, I think this is a very important investigation. We will be putting the links to your book in both English and Spanish in the description, so people look for it there. It's well worth reading. It's a very simple, clear, and important book that will give you the tools to help others emancipate themselves from this propaganda. So please go check it out and help communicate these findings to other people, because it's very important to do it, for everybody to do their part in counteracting the propaganda, because we're fighting a very large system that dominates media and academia. So we have to, you know, fight from the trenches, and everyone has to pitch in if we're going to turn this around. Enrique, thank you very much for your presentation, and I hope to see you again here next week. Everybody else, please don't forget to give us a like, to subscribe, you know, ding the bell, and share, because that's the most important. That's your real call to action, is to share, so that other people can also learn about all this.